You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
I never thought I'd get a chance to actually introduce a Pulitzer Prize winning author, but here we are. Marilyn Robinson is the Pulitzer Prize winning author, and she's going to be talking about the intersection between spirituality and faith today, but not on her own. She's going to be supported and in conversation with Andy. Andy Tait, who is Professor Andy Tait from Lancaster University. So without further ado, I'll hand you over to Andy and Marilyn.
Thank you very much. It's absolutely fantastic. It's a real honour to be interviewing you today, Marilyn. Say a little bit about you as a writer. Many people in the audience will be familiar with your fiction, with Housekeeping, with the Pulitzer Prize-winning Gilead and its subsequent novels. There was a whoop there, which is very Greenbelt. I liked that. But people will know your creative nonfiction. You as a writer of really precise, thoughtful, nuanced essays in collections like The Death of Adam, The Givenness of Things, and more recently, Reading Genesis, where you do a really deep, careful dive into that book of beginnings. And I want to really begin by thinking about you as a reader before you're a writer. You have reflected in your work on your genesis, the fact that you read carefully as a child. Can you tell me a little bit about what you read and how you read, what kind of reader you were when you were growing up, please?
Well, you know, when I was growing up, I was very much dependent on the reputations of books. You know, I didn't know what Quo Vadis was, but I heard the title around, and so I read the book, although with this kind of childish scrupulousness of reading everything word by word without necessarily understanding what I was reading. Something I recommend, in fact. But in any case, you know, I think I probably read the usual things. You know, I mean, I've always been interested in scripture. Perhaps that's the least typical of my propensities as far as reading and studying are concerned.
And did you start to read scripture, the Bible, the books of the Bible, as a child? Was that something you did as part of church practice? Was that something you did individually?
Pretty individual, actually. I was just, you know, the great texts, you sort of think, if everyone refers to this and it has the authority it appears to have, what is it actually, you know? And so, you know, I read from curiosity as much as anything else.
Absolutely, and that sense of curiosity, I think, defines a lot of your work, that you're pursuing often difficult questions, but with a strong sense of curiosity rather than judgment, to borrow a contemporary phrase. And lots of your characters seem to me very attentive readers. John Ames, your clergyman, your devout pastor in later life. You know, we know how much he reads and how carefully he reads. But also Jack, the prodigal figure in those novels, he's an attentive novelist. He's so attentive he steals books sometimes, we know as well. But you seem to be drawn to the reader as an interesting kind of protagonist and figure. So I wondered whether you see reading itself as somehow kind of transformative or even kind of spiritual, sacred in its own way.
Well, you know, the fact that human beings can actually communicate with one another and participate in the thinking that goes into, you know, articulation and so on, I think that's just amazing. You know, the fact that the barriers that we experience continuously simply can melt away or can seem to melt away because someone else has done the incredible labor of writing a book, you know. I grew up in a small town in the Northwest, and that means, you know, culture was kind of later arriving than population was in that particular part of the country, which meant that the predominant cultural activity by far was reading, you know. It wasn't unusual at all for people to be startlingly well-read, you know, and good libraries and that sort of thing. People often think if you have obscure origins, you know, that you've been deprived in some way, but they have to look farther than that into, you know, the actual circumstances of that kind of life.
So it's driven by that sense of need in a way. And I mean, it's interesting you mention reading spaces as public, as something shared, libraries. I think it's something we worry about a lot in the UK as funding disappears and libraries close. But you see that as something, you know, fundamental to good democracy, I suppose, which is another great theme in your work in lots of ways, isn't it? And something else you've written about in relation to that, I mean, we've talked about the Bible. It's I guess, unusually prominent in your work, though lots and lots of writers who might disavow faith are still dependent on what we might call kind of biblical ideas or tropes or languages. In that kind of way, but you were really very attentive to it. It's something you come back to again and again, and I recall you talking about very distinctively the advent of the authorized version, its publication and its circulation in the world a few hundred years ago, that it gave readers a much stronger sense of inwardness. I think that's a really striking term that you use. And you say, actually, they found that in the Gospel of Matthew, and then they found it in things like Walt Whitman later on, and they might have found it in Shakespeare. And now they might find it in fiction itself. That interior life, as it were. Is that something you think that's kind of distinctive to fiction in particular, that sense of inwardness, or the kind of story that we might get with bits of the biblical text?
Yes, well, you know, memoirs and things like that can be enormously important also, you know, and just history books. I read a lot of history. I think that, you know, the association of reading and democracy for me is partly that this very rich mystery, you know, develops within any human person because we all make different choices about what we will read and what we will know, you know. And there's a kind of a presumptive respect that goes with the idea that anyone could have matured any idea, you know. I think we're losing that, and not because people are less mysterious, but because their mystery is not acknowledged, you know. It's so much easier to think in shorthand.
Absolutely. I mean, the word mystery is I mean, it was really interesting that you used that right then. I noticed how common it is, or how frequently you use it in Gilead in particular. It comes up again and again in John's thoughts as he reflects. Even things that are brought out into the light are still somehow mysterious. Is that something we're in danger of losing in a contemporary reality, not just for rationalist reasons, but simply that we live in a universe that doesn't have that sense of enchantment or possibility?
I don't know how that happened, actually, because things are actually much more mysterious than they have been historically. If you read, you know, like about quantum physics or something like that, you know, good grief, you know, what could you possibly ask for in the way of mystery and cosmological, you know, amazement, you know? It's almost as if we're defending ourselves against what we know. You know, that the extraordinary singularity of life on Earth, for example, and the enormous complexity that lies behind any simplest thing, you know, we could make the psalmist look like he was a genius of understatement, you know. But the fact is, we make up, I mean, these foolish things like chatbots and so on to distract us from the fact that these endless, mysterious human beings are actually coming and going around us, you know.
Your work seems to take science very seriously, alongside religion or spirituality, and that they are in some ways interlinked. But you're much tougher on, I think, what you call parascience, particularly in a book called Absence of Mind, which I really recommend, which was based on a set of lectures you gave. And there's a kind of critique, isn't there, of a kind of science that isn't really science, that enters kind of popular lexicon and seems to be produce a kind of limit or encourages human beings to kind of lose a sense of wonder or the majesty or the magnificence of the universe in some ways. And you see that quite differently from the great achievements of curiosity that have defined great science.
It's absolutely different, you know. The fact that parascience takes its prestige from real science is a painful thing to consider. I also, you know, the idea that, for example, religious thought is a kind of an error that is answered by this version of science, you know, it diminishes both religious thought and science, you know. And, you know, we're living in difficult times, you know, but one of the things that you have to say is that amazingly beautiful things are available to us to know, you know, to ponder. And the fact that it gets convenience packaged into this, you know, nonsense is just very painful thing to consider. We might as well enjoy the things that are there to enjoy, you know.
Is that part of the motivation for your fiction as well as for your nonfiction? And your nonfiction, I think you can be delightfully tough in some ways on what you've called nonsense. You know, that you work through things, you don't, you know, there's no polemic in your work, but you do, you know, you name problems. But is there a sense of mission in your work as a whole to kind of encourage people to look again at the, you know, the wonderful strangeness of the world and its possibilities?
I mean, in a way, you're trying to give people their birthright, you know? I mean, we have erected barriers against our knowing how, you know, what a remarkable situation it is to be a human being on Earth and so on. And this is a deprivation of something. I mean, when you look at something like Genesis, you know, these people remote in time, in an amazing degree, saying, what happened? Why is there something rather than nothing? You know, what is the nature of reality? They're saying that already. We can't answer the question in an essential way, but we can give a lot of interesting footnotes and so on, you know. It would be, I think, very liberating to people to be able to think of themselves as something much larger and much more dynamic and so on than the reality that they're force-fed almost.
So it's a kind of project in some ways of defamiliarization, of asking people to look again, to forget what they think they know, but to see for themselves, perhaps.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
I hope I always make it clear where they can find whatever they would need to criticize what I say, you know.
I mean, it's really interesting in your fiction because you take both belief and unbelief quite seriously. You've got John, you've got other characters like Della who are, you know, very devout in their practice. Also, you know, we mentioned careful readers, thoughtful, not presented as perfect people, but very committed to the practice of faith in all sorts of ways. And Jack is kind of tortured, but you don't dismiss his reasons for not believing, for not being able to quite, you know, join the glory train, as it were, that he, you know, he has people encouraging him, he has people drawing him in, but he can't quite make that, I guess, that kind of leap of faith, as it were. But he seems very close to it. He's drawn back to churches all the time, isn't he? But you seem to have a profound respect for serious atheism as well.
Well, that's true. Yes, indeed, I do. I mean, I also think, I think we've erected an artificial barrier between belief and unbelief. And I think that people's thinking and feelings and so on kind of drift back and forth between one and the other, you know. I think we're allowed exploration, you know. I think that the arbitrary distinction is part of what I think Jack is struggling with, you know, an excessively acute definition of one or the other. I think that, and I think God loves interesting people. And I think that, you know, atheists are well represented in that group.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one thing that I think so many people at Greenbelt will be so happy to hear you speak is that the festival has continually pushed at those easy binaries, really. And you know, not wanting to make those simple distinctions that are often hostile, that there are other things that are worth criticising, but that it is worth celebrating that shared journey which your fiction seems so bound up with. And you're really interested as well in those historical conditions, aren't you? The kind of the worlds that you evoke aren't in a vacuum. It's very precise that we're in the 1950s. And there's the legacy of enslavement, the reality of what some people have called America's original sin. It's an original sin of lots of countries, of course, of slavery. And you have characters who have memories of the legacies of the Civil War, for example. So you take history very seriously. And I wonder what you see as the kind of the ongoing legacies of that kind of racist history in the world that you're evoking. Because it's quite uneasy, isn't it? It's not easily worked out. There are characters who are very likable, but they still, in lots of ways, aren't as progressive as perhaps they'd like to think, in some ways, perhaps. But I know you've done a lot of work around this in the kind of the background in terms of what Gilead as a town represents. It looks like Marilyn's thinking very carefully about my question, but I think I don't think my words have power to freeze the screen. There's about 25 very skilled people behind. I think Marilyn's back. So Marilyn, I asked quite a long question about the history of racism, really, and one of the difficult things that your fiction is confronting is the legacies of the Civil War, of violence, and of unresolved questions about race. And I suppose I'm kind of thinking about, you know, how you think fiction can kind of mediate that, can represent that in a contemporary reality where there are still such huge divisions and violence and real racism. Marilyn, you've muted yourself on your side, I think. This is me in every Teams meeting I've ever been in, by the way. So, thank you.
We have now many fine writers and artists of various kinds and so on who are the true and legitimate spokespeople for the historically suppressed groups, you know. I think that's a wonderful thing. I think it's amazing to see our own government rowing in the other direction, you know. I hope that's a temporary state of things. It will be, at least in the fact that, you know, we do have many fine Black writers and so on, and they will continue to write, you know. I think that Americans, you know, one of the things about the people that I write about, the Middle Westerners, is that they created many things, like the public school system, and they started many universities, and they, you know, built many churches and so, started libraries and so on. They were a very strong cultural force over decades of time, and they sort of framed American civilization in its best aspects, you know. And I think that historical memory should include them as well as everything that they so heroically struggled to eliminate. I think our history has been told to us badly. I know that too many people say that for too many reasons at this point. Nevertheless, they were the great demonstration of the fact that profound reform is possible. And that's a lesson that we should always have available to be relearned, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And so you're doing a work of kind of recovery, really, in your fiction, things that have been absent. And we learn that from your fiction. I'm probably about to pronounce a number of words badly, so please bear with me. But I think Gilead itself as a place has historical precedent. Reading your essays, you talk about a town in Iowa called Tabor, I think. And Tabor is a place that was on the Underground Railroad, so it served as a place of liberty, that it helped enslaved people escape. It also supplied Captain John Brown, who's a great, you know, abolitionist and somebody who believed in taking up arms. There was a kind of reserve and defence there for him. So you're doing something that is intimately linked with that historical reality, aren't you? I think Iowa was once known as the Day Star of Liberty. And there's an idea that that's kind of been lost by the time of Gilead, that memory is starting to disappear.
True. And now it's in deep trouble, that, you know, that legacy. My gracious, it's hard to believe. But, I mean, one of the things I was interested in, when I came to Iowa, I was, you know, new on that landscape, and I wanted to understand what I was seeing, you know, and one of the things that interested me is that the oldest buildings on the landscape tended to be colleges, which is really an unusual pattern of settlement, you know. And anyway, I would talk to people who were descendants, you know, from many generations. They had no historical memory of, you know, why this was true or where these people came from or, you know, what it was all about, really, you know. And it interested me very much that history could be lost so profoundly, when it had actually created the institutions that people lived among, you know. So I was watching the sort of tectonics, you know, of one civilization sinking under another. And frankly, that's been the theme of my existence since then, more or less, I think.
Absolutely. So you're doing that work of recovery. You're addressing a culture where there's a strong degree of historical amnesia, or cultural amnesia, sometimes we call it. And that might be reflected in the fact that there's a great war against higher education in the US at present. I mean, I think we see versions of it in the UK and Europe, but certainly very vividly. I wasn't going to mention him, but the current president, he who shall not be named, has really attacked academic freedom, it strikes me. And that part of that culture is to do with historical memory, isn't it? And the fact that there were people who stood against slavery and there were people who evangelized. I mean, that's the really interesting thing, that very often these people were people of faith. They were people who preached, who, you know, whose sermons, there wasn't a distinction between politics and liberty. We're in a different kind of moment now, but I think you're very interested in the links between certain strands of religion and a politics of liberation, for want of a better phrase. That's part of America's legacy as well. I'm thinking of a phrase where you talk even about the Puritan settlement as coming out of, I think, what you call a utopian impulse. You know, a utopian impulse. And that, again, for people at Greenbelt, is something they probably feel, that they want to build a better world. And you track that going back quite a long time. And it's not uncontroversial, because these people, of course, were colonists as well. And there's a whole kind of history there. But part of your work has been to challenge some of the thinking about Protestant and Puritan settlement in particular. Do you think that utopian impulse is still visible in contemporary America in different ways?
You know, I don't understand contemporary America. I just read an article about somebody building a white-only town in the Ozarks and so on. I suppose he would call that utopian, and to me it's something quite different. But in any case, I don't know. I mean, it seems to me as if the thing that is so astonishing as this reversal of direction of the government is the silence. great silence out there, you know? And I don't know. I mean, it's an absolutely unique historical problem, you know, and I don't blame people for not instantly knowing the best response and so on. At the same time, it's very hard to get a sense of what the response is or will be when it happens. I just feel as if I'm waiting with held breath to see who's out there and what they're going to do.
Are there any contemporary writers, really of any generation, you see doing part of that work, whether they're historians or poets or novelists? I mean, you know, I've mentioned Whitman and so on, but you've been a great appreciator of lots of those almost prophetic voices in the literary canon. But are there people that you're reading that kind of encourage you to think that these people might make a difference?
Well, you know, I know a fair number of people of that sort, and they're all opposed to what's happening, and they're all articulate, and they're all published. And the choir is preaching to itself, I think, in many cases. I hate to think that's true, but I don't see that we have a Uncle Tom's Cabin on the horizon or something like that. Although, you know, I mean, the way people have been treated so abusively, we ought to be able to write one, I think.
So do you fear that almost those progressive voices end up in what we sometimes call an echo chamber, thinking particularly about digital media, social media and so on, that novelists can end up speaking to other liberal readers or progressive readers or however we might style them, rather than changing hearts and minds of people who are currently, you know, on that train of moving backwards of what is known sometimes as a restorative nostalgia, you know, kind of trying to create a golden age of an age that never existed. I mean, that the kind of thing you're talking about in terms of that shocking idea of a white-only town, we would see that, generally speaking, any right-thinking person would see that as dystopian. But as you're saying, for the people within that town, for them, that's the world that they want to build.
It's a very tiny town. I want you to know that.
That is encouraging. it's, again, with the name Gilead, it has pop-out resonance for us as readers. You know, we might know it as a biblical reference, and it means it's a hill, isn't it? A place of witness, a place of testimony, and that has very great resonance in the kind of world that you're creating. But of course, it's also a term that was used by your contemporary, Margaret Atwood, in yes. Writing about. I'm sure you've been asked this kind of question before. Was that in any way in your mind when you were writing it, or is it pure coincidence?
I tell myself that I used that word before she did. I might be wrong about that, but
it's not here either. So. I think Margaret Atwood's agent has got to the right. So it's the connection in the US, I think. So in the meantime, should we get Marilyn back? Do be thinking of questions. Marilyn is back. In the last 10 minutes of the session, I'd be really appreciate to hear your questions. And it's Greenbelt, so I know there'll be an awful lot of them already. We were talking about Gilead, and we'd established that you used the term first, so that's a good thing in that kind of way. But it has a very strong resonance now. When people use the term Gilead, they tend
to
think...
Really?
Yeah, they tend to think of it as dystopian, but you do something quite different with it. I mean, it's very, very suggestive. Can you remember how you began with that story? You talked about the kind of historical layers... within it, it's a deeply personal book in lots of ways. It begins in that way, you know, a letter from a father who knows his days are numbered to his young son. So there's that great kind of emotional pull. Where did it begin for you?
Well, it began very well. I mean, when I have a fiction in my mind, I know it because I'm suddenly aware that I have a voice in my mind. And that was true with Housekeeping and true with Gilead, certainly. I was by myself in a hotel in Cape Cod. I just happened to have writing materials with me, you know. And I wrote the first page of that novel. And from that point on, I knew him, you know, I knew his situation. And it was actually a pleasing book to write, you know.
There was pleasure in the process and getting to know the mind, the consciousness of John.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is it a world you'll return to? You've written four. Can you imagine writing more in that universe?
I can imagine it. I can imagine making the few pages of that I've written so far into a book, you know. But it's a slight labor of the imagination, but I've done that before, you know. So
that there is something in process, which is really good. It's a slightly mischievous question, really, in that way. But we're always pleased to know, you know, when there's more in that way. I'm kind of thinking about you as somebody, obviously not writing in themes, but who addresses in your work really strong, resonant theological themes. And one of those is grace. In fact, it's the title of one of your essays in which you talk specifically about Shakespeare and restoration, reconciliation of certain relationships, parent and child, husband and wife, and so on and so forth, as a really, you know, really strong idea. In fact, you call Shakespeare my theologian in that way. So, you know, he's been a kind of guiding light as well as I guess the New Testament and the scriptures, books like Genesis. I mean, writing about something that is so resonantly theological, a word like grace has other implications, but it has a particular kind of place, doesn't it? Is that a challenge for a contemporary writer? People in some ways are anxious about the meeting between spirituality and fiction. People think it's something that's from the past, but it's been true of all of your writing, all five of the novels, and of course a lot of your criticism. So did you feel any anxiety about it, or is it something that you simply had to do?
It's myself writing from the basis of my own preoccupations, you know. I mean theological thought is very, very nourishing and beautiful and fantastic scale. It's theology is the only kind of thinking that occurs at a scale that's appropriate to the universe, you know. I feel constricted in a smaller conceptual space than that, you know. I don't, you know, frankly, if I hadn't, you can say this afterward, but if I'd never published a book, I would be happy that I had articulated thoughts that might have simply had no reality for me otherwise, you know. I've never thought much about success. I mean, I'm sounding foolish, but you know what I mean. I would never choose a book on the basis of the idea that it was marketable, you know. And frankly, I think I've kind of proved that books that would be considered not marketable actually do pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you've spoken elsewhere about the generosity of readers and the latitude, because although you will have readers who share aspects of your faith or would you know, that would be part of their identity in that way, there must be many others who see the world very differently but love your fiction and your thinking in that way. And I guess you've heard from those readers over the years. Again, I'm thinking about how figures like Shakespeare might feed into your work. I mean, as a dramatist, he's working in a very different form. I know that you did a PhD on Shakespeare simply because you mention it. I know you also say in one brilliant line that you suppose that there is enough money in the world taking foreign currency into consideration to persuade you to reread your thesis, but they would be the only circumstances. So it's not something you've revisited, but I'm guessing you revisit Shakespeare. Do you go and see adaptation on stage? Do you come back to the books? Is it something that's kind of almost imprinted on your soul from early reading and study? Is he still a figure you reckon with?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, he is my favorite theologian of the non-theological type. You know, I mean, his all of his later plays that are so full of the sort of passion of reconciliation and so on. I think that's among the greatest pieces of Christian art that we have produced. Anyone.
So a work like The Tempest that scholars tend to see as his last play ends up all about forgiveness, doesn't it, of kind of grave exactly. wrongs? Yeah.
Exactly. Sort of simile, so many of them. Winter's Tale.
Absolutely. I mean, you're very interested in that kind of whole period of history, though, that you know, the 17th century, and that includes figures like Calvin. I mean, in theology, mm-hmm. you've kind of, there's a kind of recuperation of Calvin, the death of Adam I mentioned early on. You know, is again, it's a challenge to your fellow Americans, I guess, to your fellow scholars, to rethink that basis. What does a figure like Calvin, who might have a kind of bad press... I'm not going to ask for hands up who's a Calvinist in the house. I mean, I may get a few shouts. We might need to be at another festival for that to be the case. But I guess people here are interested. What would you say Calvin has to, not so much to offer, but why should people read Calvin today, if you think they should?
Yeah. Well, one reason they should read him is to find out that he does not at all resemble the character that he's given, not only by people who dislike him, but by people who claim him, you know. He has a gloss on the text, love your enemy, love your neighbor, and who is my neighbor, and so on. And it depicts the sacredness of the encounter of one person with another, no matter how hostile that person, no matter how threatening and so on. It's very beautiful because it makes the figure of the hostile enemy into an image of God, you know. I mean, it's just very beautiful. And I think it has had more to do with my sort of anthropology than perhaps anything else that I've read. He's one of those people that is so thickly and densely misinterpreted that it's a very difficult thing to try to, you know, crack through the concrete, you know. And I mean, how many years have I gone around saying I'm a Calvinist? You know, I don't think I've made the slightest impression on anybody's conception of who he is. But it's kind of, I'm listening actually to an Audible recording of the Institutes. And you have to get through, they read the chapter headings and all this, you have to get through that. But a good voice reads him, and you can hear the ironies and the, you know, the humor and so on of a very 17th century kind, 16th century kind. But it is clarifying, because it's hard to read something without bringing the habits of interpretation to bear, you know, reading it with your own eyes.
So his interpreters have done him a great disservice in one sense. And I guess that kind of really resonates with a lot of your work, which really emphasizes decelerated, careful reading and listening, in fact. I suppose also that strong sense in your work of human beings as image bearers. You know, if we think of each other as bearing the image of God, the world would be a very, very different place. But that seems often alien from a lot of religious practice in contemporary yes. culture, and indeed in history as well. You know, yes. There's lots of mutual hatred on minor grounds.
Exactly. It's terrible when you think, I mean, anyone who took seriously the idea that other people are images of God would just faint under the incredible, you know, blasphemy of our mutual contempt for one another and so on. Whew.
I guess mutual contempt, anger, hatred come very easily in some ways. Maybe the novel as a form, reading as a form, is something that is going to challenge that. It demands empathy. It's not that somehow art makes us better people. We know in history that that isn't always the case, but it might be part to return to another theme of building a better democracy. Even though perhaps you might feel a sense of despair that anything you might have done hasn't necessarily been kind of listened to. I wonder if lots of writers historically have felt that way. And I've got another question before we open things up to the audience. And I know there'll be some really good questions here. The festival this year is called Hope in the Making. There's really good reason for you to be part of this wonderful collection of writers and thinkers and activists and musicians and so on, reflecting something that is dynamic and open and being built. What or who gives you a sense of hope, Marilyn?
Well, I mean, the people that I deal with in the ordinary course of life, you know. I think that there are more brilliant children, for example, than I could ever have imagined, you know. I tremble to think what they're going to inherit from us, but at the same time, a new beauty, you know, and something wonderful in the world. And, you know, there is the fact that I hope God isn't done with us, you know, that we have not wandered beyond the capacities of grace, which I think is not possible. I hope is not possible.
So there are hopes for you that are very much rooted in the here and now and the present, in future generations, and literally in the lives of children, but also in that notion, that divine notion of a God who might be present and active and bound up with life itself. These are big kind of Greenbelt style questions and so on. We have kind of more than 10 minutes. Do we have people who are able to bring mics around? Andy, are you able to do that at this stage?
We are indeed, yes.
That's wonderful. I can see somebody towards the front wearing a red...
Well, actually, before we do that, we've actually got a question from online, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely fine.
Yeah. It's interesting, Marilyn, you're talking there about the inner voice, the inner self. And this question comes from Shelley online, and she says, when you were working at the Iowa Writers Workshop and since, what advice would you give to writers that you believe will help sustain their process?
Well, the first thing I suppose I would say is have great respect for your own interests, for your own proclivities. You know, lots of people try to write to some sort of pre-existing conception of what a novel has to be. And that takes, you know, for one thing, the originality out of it to a great extent. And it also takes the passion of creation out of it, because you're being imitative rather than doing the thing you want to do, you know, practicing an art, you know. Very often when writers first come to us, they have to be talked out of the idea that they have to do something conventional, you know, that they have to have a vampire or something, you know what I mean? Ridiculous. But in any case, it's when they find their own voices, write something that sounds like themselves and nobody else, that, you know, is not imitative. That's when they begin, really. That's when they take hold. That certainly is the first thing, the essential thing.
Thank you so much for that. So if we go into the room, I've got my colleague Nick here, who's the roving mic. If you could stick your hands right in the air. I can see a hand there. I can see a hand there. So we've got our first three. We've got another hand there. So we've got four. So one, two, three, four, if we go in that order. Thanks. And can I just say just two things? One, if you're a Greenbelt and you thought, you know what, I'd never asked a question, do so. And secondly, this is precious time, so please, can we have questions rather than statements? Thank you.
I don't know if there are any academics in the audience, but I think Andy means you.
Count myself there, guilty as charged.
Marilyn, of the four voices in your head for the four Gilead novels we know about, which was your favourite to spend time with?
Well, I would say John Ames, because he introduced me to that world, you know. And after that, Lila. But then I like Jack awfully well also. I do enjoy my novels in the sense that I let myself think of the characters as available to my appreciation as possible, you know? So, you know, I can't choose one. I like them all.
Wonderful, fantastic.
Hi, Marilyn. So my boyfriend David's an atheist, but we both love you, and we struggle to talk about the word God, which means so much to me. I wonder if there is a word or image for God that's meaningful for you. And the second part of the question is, we're not far from Puritan Bunyan country here. So do you have a favorite Puritan or Puritan thought or idea that you could share with us? Thank you so much.
Let's see that. I'm delving here. I can't think of a better name for God than God, frankly. I mean, because it's interesting in the sense that, as I say in Genesis, it does not exclude other people's conception of something most high, most holy, you know? The non-exclusive quality of it, simply that capital G, you know, I think is something that is open to constructive interpretation. I think St. Paul, for example, certainly suggests that. God is simply a noun. It's not a name, you know. And I think that there's wisdom in that fact. But nevertheless, the Puritans, they said things like, perhaps we will be judged twice. Once when we die, and once when the final consequence of everything we do is realized. In other words, perhaps 1,000 years on, you know, perhaps things that will eventuate as destructive are not apparently so at the time that they are done, or you think that you've got away with something, you know, you think if nobody finds out about this until I die, then I got away with it. But they say, no, your actions have consequences of unlimitable forward time. And I think that's true. I think we're all living with the fact that other generations have made decisions that we have to deal with, you know, that they've probably felt we're innocent enough and that we feel as problems and afflictions. And so for our descendants, you know.
Great question.
Thanks. I don't know if slow fiction is a genre, but I think you might have created it with Gilead. And I just wondered, what kind of tensions did you have when you put that novel out into the world, given it's not what I would call your standard blockbuster?
I always knew that blocks were essentially safe from me. You know, I'm not going to bust any of them. But I didn't think about that. I just wanted to write the book and wrote it and sent it off. I have never written a book that was not published. I've written books that certainly were not blockbusters, but I knew that if I wrote it, it would be published, and that's really all I needed to know. And it was, as my books have been, very, very promptly accepted and turned around and published.
Thank you.
The thing about it is, when you do something that is not standard, you're doing something that is publishable, you know? I mean, the publishers, they have to keep the lights on, you know, and so they publish these things with gaudy covers and so on. But basically, they're waiting for something that is a sort of fresh testimony. And so, you know, there's this very coercive idea that you have to be a commercial success, but you don't. I'm here to tell you, you don't have to do that.
Brilliant.
Hi. In reading Genesis, the great heroes of Genesis come across as a pretty flawed and muddled lot. But the thing is the continuance of God's covenant to make a great people. How do you see that covenant continuing now?
I really don't feel qualified to speculate on that. I mean, certainly it's there's a great deal to wonder about at the moment. I believe in the faithfulness of God. I believe in the unbelievably perverse errors of human beings. And that's kind of the situation now, those two factors.
I recently returned and read Housekeeping for the second time and enjoyed it all the more the second sort of going returning to that world. And I just wondered, well, two parts really. Why did you not return to that world? And why so much time before you embarked on the world of Gilead?
When I started writing, which would have been with Housekeeping, I didn't like the givens of novels being published at that time, which tended to be about, you know, people having their affairs break up in a hotel room in New York or something like that. You know, I mean, over and over again, these kind of unpleasant, highly personal, you know, very restricted landscapes. This is no longer true. This is not a criticism I have now, but I certainly had it then. And it occurred to me that since I was from the mountains of Idaho, you know, I had a world that nobody else had used yet. There was no literature of my landscape. And it's a very beautiful landscape. It's wonderfully rich. So I decided that I would simply set the novel there, you know, and evoking it. I hadn't been to Idaho in about 18 years when I wrote that. I wrote much of it in France. But nevertheless, it was a deep exercise in memory, you know. I learned a great deal from it because I had no idea before how incredibly precise and vast your memory actually is. But in any case, after I wrote that, then I thought, I cannot, this is the solution to one problem. It's one solution. I can't go back to that. I would simply be repeating myself. So, you know, 24 years later, I had another landscape strongly imprinted on my mind, which is Iowa, you know. And so I thought I deprived myself of elaborations of Housekeeping for no real reason. Why should I do that again? I think that the experience of not writing more about Idaho was what made me so at ease with writing more about Iowa.
Thank you very much. Are there more questions?
Yeah, thank you. I read and loved Genesis this summer, and as a Sunday school kid who's known these stories all my life, I was coming back to them and being startled. And where I was most startled was with Joseph, who I now think of very differently. I wondered, as you were doing the deep reading and writing of Genesis, where were you startled as you came back to these old stories?
Well, you know, I have been kind of ill at ease with what I had heard as the criticism of Genesis. You know, I mean, this goes clear back to college, you know. I was teaching, as I think I said in the book, actually, I was teaching a Sunday school class in my church in Iowa. And these women who were non-Western women, I don't know where they were from, but, you know, not here, not the West. They asked what kind of God would not kill a man who killed his brother, Cain and Abel, you know. And I thought that was such an interesting question. What kind of God, you know? And this sort of freeing of the idea that we know what he's doing, you know, that those kinds of Sunday school interpretations that we get text by text and so on are not nearly adequate to the complexity of the literature, you know, the intentional enrichment of itself by repetitions and so on. So, you know, in a way, carrying that idea through that we don't know who this is, this God, you know, but he's telling us this, you know, about what his reactions to evil, sin actually are, and so on. It really did transform my thinking, which had not really been my thinking. It had been, you know, bits and parts of things that people had told me that I was never particularly comfortable with.
Hi, I just wondered if you could tell us if there are any contemporary authors that you enjoy reading yourself.
Well, you know, there should be. I mean, I have great confidence that a wonderful literary moment is underway. But the fact is that I have had tremendous trouble with my eyesight for some time. And this has narrowed my reading landscape. I simply read only things that are essential for what I'm doing. And what I'm doing is writing about Exodus. And so I'm not up to date. Since I stopped teaching, especially, I have lost the thread of what the new literature is. It gets great reviews. I read the reviews sometimes. Much more favorable than historically.
Okay, do we have one final question before we close today's session? We do, yeah, we've got one just down here. Yeah, if we could just, yeah. So this is our last question.
Marilyn, do you have a favourite gospel? And is there any chance you'll be bringing that close attention that you brought to Genesis to any of the books of the New Testament?
At the moment, I'm very interested in the Gospel of John, you know. I think that the preface to the Gospel of John is among the most beautiful things that exists. It truly does respond to the utter beauty of the first chapter of Genesis. You know, they're like the sun and the moon speaking back and forth to each other, you know. I'm actually going to speak at an event that's about the 1700th anniversary of the Nicene Creed. And it's a very sort of, it uses the kind of language that I think that the Gospel of John is the source for and an interpretive standard for. And I imagine I'll be spending a good deal of time thinking about that.
Great last question. So good. Marilyn, thank you so much.
And we have a massive Greenbelt round of applause for Marilyn Robinson and Andy Tate.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.